Well, when you hear the Iris birthday band strike up, it means it's time to celebrate a few birthdays. And who is celebrating a birthday on February 28th? Well, listener Lois Lombard of Ankeny is having a birthday. Happy birthday, Lois. And right here in Des Moines, James Lorenzen. Happy birthday, James. Hope you have a good day. And Dennis L. Stowe down in Carlisle is celebrating a birthday today. So Dennis, James, and Lois, all of us here at IRIS wish you a very, very happy birthday. You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you are hearing us on your television on Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call. And the number, 515-243-6833, so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now we'll turn to Barb for a start on today's obituaries.
Thank you, Dave. Chuck Jarnigan, age 91, of Newton, passed away on Saturday, February 24th. Services will be held at McLaren's Chapel in West Des Moines on Thursday, February 29th. Visitation will be from 12 to 2 p.m., followed by a service at 2 p.m. and burial at Rest Haven Cemetery. Chuck was born on March 26, 1932, to Hubert Jarnigan and Helen Van Buren in Monroe, Iowa. He was a member of the Newton High School class of 1950. Chuck excelled in sports all 4 years of high school. At the time, the Des Moines Register said, "It is difficult to describe with words the grace and poise Chuck displayed on a basketball floor." One of his greatest achievements was being inducted in the Iowa High School Basketball Hall of Fame in 1979. Turning down a contract with the Cleveland Indians to play baseball, he accepted a scholarship to the University of Iowa to play basketball. Here, he would become a three-year starter for the Hawkeyes and was elected captain of the team his senior year. In 1954, Chuck graduated from the University of Iowa with a bachelor's degree in physical education. Following college, Chuck married Mary Bickle, a Newton High School graduate of the class of 1948. Chuck also served 2 years in the U.S. Army. During this time, he played basketball and was named First Team All-Army Northwest Region. Chuck worked in various sales positions throughout his career, eventually working up to Vice President at Cooper Tools before he retired in 1993. Chuck then moved back to Newton to work with one of his best friends, Gary Forbes, at Forbes Office Solutions, where he retired a second time in 2013. Chuck had a sharp wit and a great sense of humor that, along with his storytelling, built an instant connection with everyone he met. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to Wesley Life Hospice and Jasper County Elderly Nutrition. Alice Rush of St. Charles. Funeral services in memory of Alice will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, February 29th at Kale Funeral Home in Osceola. Burial will follow at Westerville Cemetery in Decatur County. The family will be available to greet friends from 6 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday evening at the funeral home. Memorial contributions may be directed to Every Step Hospice, Cavanaugh House on 56th in Des Moines. Alice dedicated over 41 years of her life working as an underwriter for state automobile and casualty underwriters, eventually retiring in 1986. Alice will be remembered by her surviving sister-in-law, along with numerous nieces, nephews, other relatives, and many dear family friends. Ronald Herbert Brommert, 83, of Urbandale, passed away on February 21st at Bishop Drum Retirement Center in Johnston. A public visitation will be held on March 4th at St. Teresa Catholic Church from 10 a.m. until 11 a.m., with a funeral mass to follow at 11 a.m. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions can be made to Bishop Drum Retirement Center, that's at 5837 Winwood Drive in Johnston, 50131, or St. Teresa Catholic Church, 1230 Merle Hay Road in Des Moines, 50311. For a complete obituary, visit CaldwellParish.com. Brian Douglas Fuller, 63, of Indianola, passed away peacefully on February 23rd. Brian was born on December 11, 1960, to Donald and Janice Fuller in Davenport, Iowa. He graduated from Indianola High School in 1979 and later earned a degree from DMAC. He and Lori had two daughters, Nicole and Jamie. He is survived by his two brothers, two daughters, two grandsons, and two grandsons. Visitation will be held on March 28th at 10 a.m. at Redeemer Lutheran in Indianola, with a memorial service to follow afterward at 11 a.m. James, known as Jim Vincent Quinn of Perry, passed away on February 23rd at Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. A massive Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 1st, at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Perry. A visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the Mass. Burial will be at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Elkhorn, Nebraska. Memorial contributions may be given to St. Patrick's Catholic Church or the Central Iowa Tractor Club Scholarship Fund. Online condolences may be expressed at CaldwellParish.com. And to read the full obituary, also go to CaldwellParish.com. Walter Delano Lemer, 91, passed away peacefully, surrounded by family, on Saturday, February 17th, at VA Medical Center in Des Moines. He was born December 14th, 1932, in Shell City, Missouri, to William Delano and Helen Frances Lemer. He was a dedicated Iowa Hawkeye fan and loved spending time with family. Walter is survived by his loving wife of 64 years, son Scott, and granddaughter, Brittany. Celebration of life service will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 2nd, at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Waukee, with visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. prior. Private burial will be in May of 2024 at Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel. Online condolences may be expressed at islescares.com. Amy Jo Martin, 56, passed away peacefully on February 22nd, surrounded by her loving family. Born on March 7, 1967, to Pat and Mary Martin, Amy's vibrant spirit touched lives of all who knew her. Amy adored her family, finding joy in every moment spent with them. She had a passion for the Oak Ridge Boys, her favorite candy bar, the Three Musketeers, and the simple pleasure of coloring and watching movies. Amy's warm heart and welcoming nature made her the first person to greet guests at her door, and her love for her cats knew no bounds. She is survived by her mother, two brothers, a niece and nephew. Please join Amy's family for a celebration of life on Friday, March 1st, from 5 to 8:30 p.m. at Terrace Hill Golf Course, 8700 Northeast 46th Avenue in Altoona. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Lions Eye Bank, Mainstream Living, or Easter Seals in loving memory of Amy. Amy will be deeply missed by her, but forever remembered for her infectious laughter, kind soul, and unwavering love for those she held dear. Many people walk in and out of your life, but few leave a footprint in your heart like Amy. Online condolences may be expressed at hamiltonsfuneralhome.com. And Roberta Jean Oxley, known as Bobby, 82, of Clinton, Wisconsin, passed away on Wednesday, February 21st, after a long struggle with dementia. Roberta Jean Singler was born to Lawrence and Lenore Singler in 1942 in Fort Dodge, one of three children. She graduated from Fort Dodge High School and worked hard in many positions and as a stay-at-home mom before her retirement. She married her true love, Robert Oxley, on his birthday in 1963. He is survived by her brothers as well as her four children, as well as 10 grandchildren. Bobby was preceded in death by her husband and her parents. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers or cards, the family asked that donations be made to the Alzheimer's Association.
Thank you, Barb, and that concludes obituaries for today. I'll now turn back to Section A, and that's on page 6. The United States Supreme Court is skeptical of social media laws. The Supreme Court sounded skeptical Monday of the broad sweep of laws passed by Texas and Florida to regulate powerful social media companies, but struggled with how to assess huge First Amendment implications of the controversial legislation. The justices spent nearly 4 hours debating one of the most closely watched and politically tinged cases of the year. The decision could change the way millions of Americans interact with social media ahead of the presidential election. During a raging debate about how social media handles political content and misinformation, Texas and Florida passed laws in 2021 limiting the ability of social media giants to regulate user content. Inspired in part by the decision of Twitter and other major platforms to suspend former President Donald Trump after the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol, the laws severely limit the ability of social media companies to kick users off their platforms or remove individual posts for violating a platform's rules. Both state laws have been temporarily paused while the Supreme Court hears the case. At stake is whether the First Amendment shields social media platforms for their handling of controversial voices and views, a critical question as Facebook, YouTube, and X play an ever-growing role in the lives of Americans and democracy. Chief Justice John Roberts said the case turns on whether the judgment about who can and cannot post content is a decision left up to a government entity or to the social media platforms. The First Amendment, Roberts said, has a thumb on the scale when that question is asked. The State Department and trade groups representing social media companies argue the Supreme Court should strike down the laws because they infringe on the company's First Amendment right to free speech. That would be consistent with the court's 1974 ruling that Florida could not require a newspaper to publish replies to editorials. This case involves editorial decisions at its heart, said former U.S. Solicitor General Paul Clement, who represented the social media sites. If the platforms have to post any and all content, he said, the sites will become, quote, gobbledygook, end quote. Florida and Texas say social media platforms are less like newspapers and more like telephone companies that are transmitting content generated by customers not creating it themselves. Because everyone today communicates online, if the big social media companies are allowed to stifle certain viewpoints, there will be no public square to speak of, Texas Solicitor General Aaron Nielsen told the court. Moreover, Florida Solicitor General Henry Whitaker said Facebook and X are different from newspapers because they have no space constraints, so it's less burdensome to require them to display any content a user may post. Arguing for the Justice Department, Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar urged the court to make a narrow approach and simply rule that the states cannot tell Facebook, YouTube, and X how to moderate their content while taking a pass, for now, on other questions about regulating social media. It's not necessary here to try to figure out how the First Amendment applies to new technology in general or to every possible website or the internet in particular, she said. The justices complained that they did not have enough information about which sites would be affected by the laws and what actions on those sites might be covered. For instance, if LinkedIn post a virtual job fair, would its rules about who can participate have to comply with Florida's law? Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asked. Whitaker responded that he wasn't, quote, totally aware of all the facts, end quote, in such a scenario. I think that's a problem, Jackson said. When Justice Samuel Alito asked for a list of all the sites covered by Florida's law, the state solicitor general said he did not have one. The states and the social media companies also disagreed over what would happen if the laws were allowed to take effect. Clement, arguing for the social media companies, said some of the companies might allow only posts about puppy dogs, at least in Florida, until we can get this straightened out. We'd sort of have to fundamentally change our business models, Clement said, and I think each company is going to make their own judgment about how they'd come into compliance. Justice Kavanaugh asked whether a site could block a post that praises the terrorist group Al-Qaeda. You cannot very well say you can have the anti-Al-Qaeda, but not the pro-Al-Qaeda. Nielsen responded for Texas. If you just want to say, no one's talking about Al-Qaeda here, they can turn that off. The Supreme Court has long held that the First Amendment does not permit viewpoint discrimination, supporting one side of an issue but not the other. It wasn't clear whether social media companies could react by pulling out of Texas altogether to avoid restrictions. Some justices pointed out that while there may be no physical space constraints, there are constraints of attention. Users rely on the websites to curate for them. Even though it has infinite space, it really does not, because viewers, myself included, or users, cannot access the millions of things that are on the internet and actually get through them and pick the things they want because there's too much information, said Justice Sonia Sotomayor. We're limited by human attention spans. Alito rejected the 20th century comparisons made by both sides. You say this is just like a newspaper, he told Clement, and the states say no, this is like Western Union. It's like a telegraph company. I look at this and I say, it's not really like that either of those. More important, I don't know how we can decide this case by jumping to one side or the other, he said. A decision is expected in late June.
Three congressional fights may affect your finances. It's easy to tune out Congress' ongoing squabbles, but Americans may want to pay attention to three major issues that could affect their wallets. The current budget face-off includes extra funding for two programs that help low-income people pay for food and energy: the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, known as WIC, and the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program, LIHEAP. Both need budget approval to keep operating at full steam. Separately, a multi-year enhanced child tax credit that passed the House in January is stuck in the Senate. If it passed, as many as 400,000 children would be lifted out of poverty in the first year, said the left-leaning Center on Budget and Policy Priorities think tank. Quote, the three programs together will make a significant difference in strengthening low-income families, said Mark Wolf, director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association. WIC provides nutrition assistance to 6.7 million women and children, and participation is rising as more Americans struggle financially. To serve them, WIC needs another $1 billion, the United States Department of Agriculture said in December. In the last two stopgap measures to keep the government running, Congress didn't provide additional money. If Congress doesn't act now, states will have to make tough choices, said Craig Moschetti, senior manager of policy for Share Our Strengths, No Kid Hungry campaign. Eligible families could be waitlisted, be turned away, or have their benefits cut for the first time in 30 years. The Center on Budget of Policy Priorities estimates about 2 million children and mothers nationwide would be cut by September, with harm falling disproportionately on Black and Hispanic families. LIHEAP spent its $4.1 billion grant, plus a supplemental $2 billion in fiscal year 2023, to help a record 7.1 million households. The program wants to keep funding at that $6.1 billion total. I keep hearing back from the Hill that it will be tough, Wolf said. Additional funding looks grim. At least 1 million households would be cut from the program, he said. A record 16% of households, or 21.2 million, are already behind on their energy bills. During calendar year 2023, this unpaid debt increased from $17.7 billion to $20.3 billion, Wolf said. Energy prices are coming down but remain high, he said. States are reporting that they are cutting back on emergency funds, closing their programs early, and scaling back or not planning to offer cooling assistance. In January, the House passed a bill that would allow a larger portion of the child tax credit to be refundable, retroactive to tax year 2023. Americans are filing those returns now. If the bill passes the Senate, the IRS will recalculate your taxes to see if you're entitled to more refund money. The refundable portion of the $2,000 tax credit would increase from $1,600 to $1,800 for tax year 2023. It would increase to $1,900 for 2024 and to $2,000 for 2025. However, the Senate hasn't put the bill up for a vote. Some senators, like ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee Mike Crapo, Republican of Idaho, and Mark Rubio, Republican of Florida, say the bill would turn the child tax credit into welfare instead of tax relief for working Americans. Others, like Mitt Romney, Republican of Utah, say the plan is too costly. And police say an Oregon girl's remains have been identified decades later. A teenage girl from Portland, Oregon, who was reported missing more than 50 years ago, was identified through DNA after her relatives began uploading their information into a national database, the Oregon State Police say. Sandra Young has regained her identity since her disappearance in the late 1960s, police said. Her story represents a remarkable amount of diligence and collaboration between family members, detectives, Oregon State Medical Examiner staff, and our contact laboratory, Parabon Nanolabs, said Nikki Vance, the state's Human Identification Program Coordinator at the Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office. There are few details on Young's disappearance, which occurred in either 1968 or 1969, making her 17 or 18 years old at the time. But authorities were able to identify Young through genetic genealogy, which uses genealogical DNA tests and traditional genealogical methods to determine the familial relationships between individuals. Quote, this technology gives investigators the powerful ability to assist all Oregon agencies with the resolution of their cold case mysteries, Vance said in the release. A Boy Scout walking along the far north end of Sauvie Island in Oregon's Columbia County on February 23, 1970, saw what seemed like just clothes. Once a scout looked deeper, he found Young's body, according to Oregon State Police. When investigators went to recover Young's remains, they found a black curly wig, Oregon Wigs police said. From that point, investigators were under the belief that the body belonged to a black person who died from trauma to the body. Evidence also pointed to foul play being involved. Her remains were removed in 2004 to the State Medical Examiner Facility in Clackamas County, along with more than 100 other sets of unidentified remains. Momentum didn't start to come into the case until 2018, when the Oregon State Police Medical Examiner's Office received a grant to fund the use of DNA techniques, including genetic genealogy, police said. Different DNA techniques were used by Parabon Nanolabs, a Virginia-based company that provides DNA phenotyping services to law enforcement to create a better picture of Young, including her eye color, hair color, skin color, and ancestry. Further genetic testing by Parabon Nanolabs in 2021 predicted Young's facial characteristics, according to police. To see her face come to life through DNA phenotyping was striking, Vance said in the release. When a distant family member in January 2023 uploaded their DNA into the GED match, an open-source genetic genealogy database, it matched with Young's. A more complete picture of Young's family began to form as other family members uploaded their DNA. Young's identity became even clearer when genetic genealogists determined she was a sister of one of the people who uploaded their DNA. Subsequent interviews and DNA testing led not only to Young's identification, but also to her family's cooperation and the Portland Police Bureau being contacted about potentially conducting a follow-up investigation into the missing teenager's death.
Thank you, Barb. I'll now turn to news from across the 50 states. Short little stories here, and I'll start with Iowa and the surrounding states. Iowa State University hopes to fine-tune its tornado research by building a facility that can simulate 200-mile-per-hour wind speeds. The university plans to construct the National Testing Facility for Enhancing Wind Resiliency for Infrastructure in Tornado, Downburst, Gust, Front Events, in a smaller-scale prototype to help study the impact of tornadoes and other severe levels of wind. In Illinois, multiple organizations focused on South Peoria and the environment are pushing for changes to a tax increment financing district proposal. Groups are worried that the distillery TIF could also invite a new carbon dioxide pipeline from a company such as BioYurja, an ethanol plant that also falls within the boundaries. Up in Minnesota, a man suspected in the September 2023 murder of a 31-year-old woman in Los Angeles has been arrested in Minnesota, according to police. In Missouri, Prime Beef Packers, a meatpacking facility located in Pleasant Hope, announced it is temporarily suspending operations. This comes after the facility rescinded its request to the Missouri Department of Natural Resources to dump more than 350,000 gallons of treated wastewater per day into the Paume de Terre River. Over in Nebraska, a first-of-its-kind study from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln shows that the Midwest may see a decline in blizzard occurrence, suggesting a reduced risk of winter hazards. And in Wisconsin, the abortion clinic on Milwaukee's east side, run by Affiliated Medical Services, is slated to reopen next month, making it the latest clinic to resume abortions in Wisconsin. Up in Pierre, South Dakota, drug dealers who sell fentanyl or drugs laced with the potent synthetic opioid that then results in a drug user's death could be impacted by an update to South Dakota's death by distribution law after a House Judiciary Committee vote. And now, as we're getting close to our shift change, we'll turn it over to Barb, and she can do a couple more 50 states, and then we can move on.
Sure. In South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina, the state was only of two states in the AS to report no snow this winter, and meteorologists say it is doubtful the area will get snow anytime soon. In Newport, Rhode Island, from unattainable prices to racial discrimination, Newporters share their concerns over the state of the city's housing market. In an open house last week, the city's planning department is working on a housing study to better understand the state of the city's housing stock and what should be done to improve housing availability.
The last 90 minutes, your readers have been Dave Stutz and Barb DeHeck. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to allow our next readers to get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Patty Daniels and myself, Scott Splavik. We'll continue with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Now here's Patty with our first article.
This is from the opinion page. Excuse me. How Black History is White House History, written for us by Stuart D. McLaurin. Black History Month is a perfect time to reflect on the lasting contributions that so many Black Americans, famous and anonymous, have made to White House history. Black Americans help raise its walls. For centuries, they've done much of the work that makes the White House run, and in the face of arduous legal, social, and political barriers, a multitude of Black Americans have opened presidential minds, challenged our leaders to deliver on America's promises, and made history themselves. A free Black man, Benjamin Banneker, helped map the boundaries of America's new capital city and urged future President Thomas Jefferson to aid Black Americans to his cause for liberty. For 8 years, over 200 people were forced to quarry stone, cut timber, make bricks, and raise walls and roofs to help build the White House. In the decades that followed, free and enslaved Black people were key to the functioning of the White House as it rose to a center of national power. During the War of 1812, as the British approached to burn the White House, an enslaved man named Paul Jennings helped move George Washington's portrait to safety. Jennings later helped 77 people in a daring escape that fueled the growing anti-slavery movement in the United States. Black Americans influenced the Civil War. Frederick Douglass helped move President Abraham Lincoln from general opposition on slavery to working to abolish it. He used a White House visit to press Lincoln to pay Black soldiers equal wages and retaliate against Confederate execution of Black prisoners. Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, who earned money as a seamstress to buy her freedom, became a dressmaker for First Lady Mary Lincoln and tended to Lincoln's dying son, Willie. She created a charity to support camps of newly freed people in Washington, D.C., and persuaded the Lincolns to support the cause. By the middle of the 19th century, Black Americans were carving out an important place on the White House's cultural stage. The Fisk Jubilee Singers, who shunned traditional minstrels to introduce the spiritual as an American art form, are believed to be the first Black choir to perform at the White House. Black soprano Marie Celica Williams' acclaimed Green Room performance for President Rutherford Hayes in 1878 inaugurated a tradition of musicales that continues today. But access and influence on policy matters came more slowly. In 1901, Theodore Roosevelt invited Booker T. Washington, who advised the president on race relations, to dine with him at the White House, a historic first that triggered scathing editorials. William Monroe Trotter, who founded a newspaper that fought racial discrimination, confronted President Woodrow Wilson in a White House meeting over his decision to allow the racial segregation of government clerks to no avail. Black women also played a role in the gradual opening of White House doors. When First Lady Lou Hoover included the wife of Black Congressman Oscar DePriest on the list for a White House tea in the late 1920s, a controversy ensued. Mrs. DePriest was able to break ground by attending a separate gathering Mrs. Hoover hosted with more open-minded wives. In 1939, after the Daughters of the American Revolution refused to let Marian Anderson sing at Constitution Hall because she was Black, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt was angered enough to resign from the organization. Marian Anderson did perform at the White House at Mrs. Roosevelt's invitation.
As the civil rights movement became a national force in the 1960s, White House doors finally began to open more often. Martin Luther King Jr. and other black leaders visited the Oval Office to advise and put pressure on Presidents John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson to move forward. When iconic civil rights laws were finally passed, black leaders were part of the White House signing ceremonies. The second half of the 20th century also saw black people breaking into the ranks of senior White House staff and other executive leadership roles. President Dwight Eisenhower made E. Frederick Morrow the first black person to serve in an executive presidential staff position, though he was generally disappointed with the administration's civil rights policies. Clifford Alexander, a deputy special counsel to Johnson, became the first black secretary of the Army. Robert J. Brown developed minority enterprise and black college programs for President Richard Nixon. Togo West served as Secretary of the Army under President Bill Clinton, who later appointed him to be the first black Secretary of Veterans Affairs. In the decades that followed, the influence of black advisors reached the highest levels of the White House. Former National Urban League head Vernon Jordan became a close confidant to Clinton. Colin Powell served President Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush as the first black national security advisor and Secretary of State. In 2001, Condoleezza Rice was appointed national security advisor by President Bush, then succeeded Powell as Secretary of State. In 2009, a black president and black first lady entered the White House, a milestone day that some had feared would never come. The Obamas were conscious of the centuries of black history that preceded them. The struggles of Rosa Parks and Coretta Scott King were more familiar to me than those of Eleanor Roosevelt or Mamie Eisenhower, Michelle Obama wrote in her autobiography. I carried their histories along with those of my mother and grandmothers. The White House Historical Association works to keep these memories alive by funding the acquisition of works by black artists and placing markers in Lafayette Park to tell the story of these enslaved workers. Similar recognition would strengthen the stories told at the White House itself, as well as pre-White House presidential residences in New York and Philadelphia, where enslaved people labored. Like the hardships and injustices that black people have faced, black achievement has been foundational to the U.S. story. The progress made and the challenges remaining are just as central to White House history. Now, Stuart McLaren is president of the White House Historical Association. This was founded, by the way, by Jacqueline Kennedy in 1961.
Thank you, Patty. Our second opinion piece is entitled "To Fight Anti-Semitism, Change How We Teach Jewish Studies." It's written by Merrill Ain, who is a writer, author, podcaster, and career educator. As the author of two post-Holocaust novels, a speaker on the lessons of the Holocaust, and a former high school history teacher who has promoted Holocaust education since the 1970s, recent events have convinced me that more must be done to educate students about the Jewish people. Just as black studies education must go beyond teaching about the horrors of slavery, the story of the Jewish people and their history must go beyond Holocaust education. This is at a time when fewer than half the states in this country even mandate Holocaust education in their public schools. What we saw after October 7th made it abundantly clear that Holocaust education is not an inoculation against anti-Semitism. The proof is that after the surprise early morning Hamas attack on primarily Jewish civilians, whom they butchered, beheaded, and raped, killing 1,200 and kidnapping 240, a tsunami of anti-Semitism followed. Whatever sympathy and empathy the Jewish initially received was quickly replaced with attacks against them, both verbal and physical, in the United States and throughout the world. In Germany, there was a 320% increase in anti-Semitism in the 2 months after the attack. Early this month, a 30-year-old Jewish student was assaulted and hospitalized with facial fractures after a 23-year-old pro-Palestinian student in Berlin violently attacked him during an argument, repeatedly kicking him after he was knocked to the ground. In the United States, according to the Anti-Defamation League, there was a 388% increase in anti-Semitic hate crimes in October over the same period last year. Jewish students on college campuses, those wearing Jewish symbols on the street, as well as synagogues and Jewish community centers have all been targeted. The result is increased and costly security measures. But what else is needed in addition to enhanced security? Besides empathy, compassion, and longer attention spans, an educational overhaul is needed from elementary school through college. All young people would benefit from a robust understanding of Jewish and Israeli history. Respect for Jews and the Jewish tradition should not be based on pity, but rather on respect and admiration. We need to teach the accomplishments and perspectives that are uniquely Jewish, such as monotheism, as well as the concept of tzedakah, charity. These were and are ideas and ideals that Judaism contributed and continues to contribute to the world. Israel itself is a model of high-tech and medical innovation. It not only desalinated salt water, but it made the desert bloom. It is the only country in the Middle East where the LGBTQ+ community can live in freedom without fear. Unlike the popular American canard that all Jews are creatures of white privilege, Israel is proof that Jews come in all colors and denominations. Jews have contributed mightily to this country and to the world. One of the most amazing Nobel Prize statistics is that 22% of winners have been Jewish, although Jews make up only 0.2% of the world's population. Two Jews, Jonas Salk and Albert Sabin, eradicated the scourge of polio with their vaccines. Who doesn't love the music of Lennon and Cohen, Leonard Cohen, Itzhak Perlman, Carole King, and Paul Simon? Irving Berlin wrote the classic Christmas and Easter song that remain the staples of the two major Christian holiday seasons, White Christmas and Easter Parade. And people throughout the world have been moved, inspired, and entertained by Steven Spielberg movies. Jewish and non-Jewish young people need the information and the tools to respond to the abundant misinformation that is proliferating. They need to be educated about the history of the Jews, including acts of anti-Semitism that have gone on for millennia. They should learn that there was political anti-Semitism in Germany and Austria in the 1870s, and that Hitler drew upon a fertile playbook. And we all need to remind ourselves that it was only in 1965 that the Catholic Church, for the first time, proclaimed that the death of Jesus Christ cannot be charged against all the Jews without distinction, then alive, nor against the Jews of today. We need a huge educational initiative and media campaign to counteract the rampant hatred polluting our country and the world and putting all Jews everywhere in harm's way. We can also stop hate with small steps. In 1968, after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Jane Elliott taught a lesson to her class of all white students where she separated them according to eye color. The blue-eyed students were told to discriminate against the brown-eyed children, then vice versa. The results were shocking. Students began to discriminate against one another based on eye color. But at the end of the exercise, the students said they had learned that it was wrong to judge someone on the color of their eyes. It is incumbent on all of us, Jews and non-Jews, to start immediately to develop and lobby for better ways of teaching our children how not to hate. But at the same time, we should convey that Jews are not just victims or stereotypes. We must share the many ways Jewish ideals and individuals have contributed to the lives of people of all backgrounds. The time is now to call upon leaders in education, government, the private sector, and philanthropy to act. Who will be the first to step up to the plate before it's too late? And again, this was written by Merrill Ain, who is a writer, author, podcaster, and career educator. Patty?
Thank you. It's time for Sports on TV. Wednesday, February 28th. All times that we see here are Eastern. Canadian Hockey League, 7 p.m. NHLN, Oshawa at London. College Basketball, Men's, 6:30 p.m. CBSSN, Rhode Island at VCU. SECN, Missouri at Florida. 7 p.m. ACCN, Louisville at Duke. BTN, Northwestern at Maryland. ESPN2, Auburn at Tennessee. ESPNU, Furman at Western Carolina. FS1, Providence at Marquette. FS2, DePaul at Xavier. 8 p.m., PAC12N, California at Colorado. 8:30 p.m., CBSSN, St. John's at Butler. SECN, South Carolina at Texas A&M. 9 p.m., BTN, Minnesota at Illinois. ESPN2, Alabama at Mississippi. ESPNU, Virginia at Boston College. FS1, Seton Hall at Creighton. 10 p.m., PAC12N, Arizona at Arizona State. 11 p.m., FS1, Oregon State at Oregon. College Basketball Women's, 7 p.m. on Peacock, Michigan at Ohio State. 9 p.m. Peacock, Iowa at Minnesota. 11 p.m. ESPNU, Portland at Gonzaga. College Swimming and Diving, 5:30 p.m. PAC12N, PAC12 Championships. 1M Diving, Federal Way, Washington. Golf, 9:30 p.m., Golf LPGA Tour, the HSBC Women's World Championship, first round, Sentosa Golf Club, Tanjong Course, Singapore. Major League Baseball, 1 p.m., MLBN Spring Trainee, Atlanta versus Philadelphia, Clearwater, Florida. NBA Basketball, 7:30 p.m., ESPN, New Orleans at Indiana. 10 p.m., ESPN, L.A. Lakers at L.A. Clippers. NHL Hockey, 8:30 p.m., TNT and Max, St. Louis at Edmonton. Men's Soccer, 2:50 p.m., FS2, the French Cup. Valenciennes at FC Rouen, 1899, quarterfinal. 8:55 p.m., FS2, CONCACAF Champions Cup. Mocha FC at Nashville, South Carolina. First round, leg two. Women's Soccer, 1 p.m., CBSSN, UEFA, Nations League, Spain versus France, promotion and relegation matches, second leg in Seville, Spain. Tennis, 5 a.m., San Diego, WTA, Acapulco, Dubai ATP, and Santiago ATP, early round. 1 p.m., tennis, San Diego, WTA, Acapulco, ATP, Austin, WTA, Dubai, ATP, and Santiago, ATP, early rounds. And lastly, at 9 p.m., we have tennis. San Diego, WTA, Acapulco, ATP, Austin, WTA, Dubai, ATP, and Santiago, ATP, early rounds.
That's a whole lot of initials there. Hopefully everybody understood. As we know, the girls' high school basketball state tournament is going on, and we've got a few stories related to that. I won't have time to read the stories, but I can let you know that, Ava Zediker of Dowling Catholic scored 29 points to power Dowling to a win, 53-49 over Pleasant Valley on Monday. Also in the 4A quarterfinals, the number 5 seed North Polk Comets outscored number 4 Dallas Center Grimes 24-10 down the stretch to pull off a 48-42 victory on Tuesday. And I don't know if it's 2A or 3A, what it is, but it was a two-person game for the Des Moines Christian team on Monday night as Abby Hall and Addie Otker combined for 34 points of the Lions' 49 points en route to a 49-46 state basketball quarterfinal over Benton Community. So that's some of the local scores and outcomes from the girls' tournament. Other scores yesterday in Class 4A, Clear Creek Amana defeated Gilbert 68-30. And as I said, North Polk defeated Dallas Center Grimes 48-42. Waverly Shell Rock played Sioux Center last night. Apparently the score did not make the paper today. And Sioux City Bishop Helan played Lewis Central as well. And that was a late game, so we don't have those results in today's paper. Now it's time to move to Dear Abby. And it's entitled, In-Laws Keep Spouses Off Family-Only Text Thread. Dear Abby, I recently married and was excited to be part of my husband's family. My own siblings and I are not particularly close. During COVID, one of my husband's sisters started a family text chain in which they share what's happening in their lives. I thought it was a great idea. Not technically being a family member yet, I understood why I wasn't included in the thread, but after our wedding, I wasn't added to the chain. Come to find out, none of the spouses are included. I have also learned from my husband that his mother really had no use for any of her kids' spouses because technically, quote, we are not one of them, end quote. They aren't sharing earth-shattering information with one another. It's normally fun stuff or things their kids are up to, etc. It is very hurtful that I'm not included. I have to hear everything secondhand from my husband. Am I wrong to feel this way? I asked him to add me to the list and he tried, but he couldn't. Instead of pursuing it with his sister, he just dropped it. I have asked him several times to see what he can do, to no avail. I feel like he doesn't have my back. Your advice? Signed, Left Out in Florida. Abby replies, Dear Left Out, your husband doesn't have enough power in his family to do what you have been requesting, which is regrettable. Rather than pout, consider starting a text chain of your own, comprised of all the outcasts who have been excluded from the Our Bloodline and Nobody Else chain. It might be fun, and you may find it's a club that is welcoming and has some interesting things to say. Our second letter, Dear Abby, my wife of 26 years is having an affair with another married man. We have teenage kids, and so does he. She has been having him over and meeting him out for the last 4 months. The kids have noticed how she takes off in the middle of the day for hours to do a solo hike. Several times, my teenage daughter has called me at work, frantic, saying Mom is not answering either of her phones and was supposed to pick her up at the agreed-upon location. My wife claims to love us both and wants to continue both relationships. For our family's sake, it is sad that this has happened. He is the manager of a local business, and I encounter him from time to time. I want to ask him how he thinks this is okay. What should I do? Sharing her in Massachusetts is how that letter is signed. Abby replies, Dear Sharing Her, make up your mind about what kind of marriage you want. If it's what you are experiencing now, do nothing. However, if it isn't, Tell your wandering wife she must end the affair now. Offer her the option of counseling to see if you can get your marriage back on track. Instead of talking with the man she's having the fling with, tell his wife what has been happening. If she's unaware that your wife is being so irresponsible she would leave her daughter stranded while she's quote-unquote hiking is disgraceful. If your wife refuses counseling, contact an attorney. And let's see, we just have a few more minutes, and I don't know what I'm going to read. You got anything over there, Patty? I guess we'll just have to end it here. That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, Wednesday, February the 28th, 2024. I'm Scott Splavik, and my partner at the microphone has been Patty Daniels. Earlier, you heard Barb DeHeck and Dave Stutz. You can listen to Iris programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bendsoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.